Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Good Radio Network, radio that does a world of good. This isn't your average talk radio show.
Blah, 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 blah.
We're blasting away the old tried and not so true mold. Instead, TGRN turns talk into action. And action leads to doing positive things for people, our environment, and even the animals.
Well, I'm only one person. What can I do?
A lot. Join host Frankie Picasso while she turns talk into doing and gets results. This is the Good Radio Network. Yes, you can do it if you try, even if you're just a regular guy. Now, here's your host, Frankie Picasso.
Good day, good day, good day, and welcome to the Good Radio Network. Hi, how are you? My name is Frankie Picasso. I am your host today. Thanks again for joining us. I encourage you to join in the conversation as well. So if you'd like to call in, our number is 845-241-9943. Again, 845-241-9943. And just hit 1 so that you show up in the host queue. That lets me know that you want to talk. Okay. Well, before I introduce my guest to you today, I want to give you the good minute, as usual. Today, I'm going to talk about Matt and Amy. They got married this week, and she wore a beautiful pink dress, and he wore a tuxedo T-shirt. They both sported matching ring pops, and you see, Amy is 4 years old, and she's a leukemia patient in an Albany, New York medical center. And Matt, her groom, is her favorite male nurse, and the hospital arranged the whole event within like 24 hours, and Amy stated it was the best day ever. So you can watch the video of Matt and Amy getting married at the Good Radio Network on our blog.com, and I think this is probably a perfect segue to introduce you to my guest today, whose book is also about being chosen as a bride. She's a young woman who has accomplished an amazing feat. She has published her first novel, and it is fantastic. The Choosing was released on May 15th, and since then, women are having conversations about central themes to the book: identity, self-worth, self-esteem, faith, fear, and love. And I won't say that the torch has passed from father to daughter, because I think Ted Decker still has a lot of storytelling to do. But the talent certainly found its way into her DNA. And along with that big, bright smile, Ted's eldest daughter, Rochelle Decker, has certainly come out of the gate strong with a powerful story and a winning novel. Now, Rochelle graduated with a degree in communications, and she spent several years in marketing and corporate recruiting before making her full transition to writing. And writing full-time, I should say. And today she lives in Nashville with her husband, Daniel. And I also have a husband, Daniel, and her diva cat, Blair. Welcome, Rochelle.
Thank you.
Wow, that's quite an accomplishment. I mean, it's a huge feat to, A, finish a novel, and B, have it so well received. And I have to say that, you know, I'm going to say this once, and I'm not going to say it again. I, you know, bow down to the feet of your father. I have read everything he's ever written. I've seen him in person talking. And I think everything he's done is brilliant. But, you know, you really do stand on your own 2 feet. You are a fantastic writer. And I just have to put that out there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I have as well read everything he's written and seen him speak many times. So they were big shoes to fill. So instead of trying to fill them, I kind of just did my own thing, was, you know, hopefully faithful to who I have become, and just put it out there and wish for the best. So I really appreciate that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because as I read your book, I felt some themes central to your father as well, the idea of the father, the idea of, you know, God in your work. And mm-hmm. I found it, you know, the character Aaron, I found it interesting. And I wonder, does that come from sitting around the kitchen table as children discussing faith? And like, where does it come just naturally to you?
No, a little bit of probably both. I would say probably not sitting around the table as children. I think at that point in my father's career, when I was at home as a child, he was writing a lot more suspense, some of his creepy, eerie novels that people love. And so he kind of started a different journey into writing after I had actually already moved out and gone to college. And so this was just you know, this idea of identity and, you know, my character, Aaron, who you mentioned, who is definitely, I think, probably part Ted in certain regards. came from hours of conversation on the phone when I was going through who am I as an individual, you know, as I was becoming a young woman, who what defines me, what is my purpose, what makes living life worth it, and really calling my dad for advice, calling other people around me. And so a lot of this journey and transformation took place for me much, you know, later than a child in the home. And I think that's true of my father as well. He kind of went on a different kind of journey of identity and truth much later as well. And so I just, heard lots of discussion from him. I always call him for advice on that. But I think we definitely have very similar views on faith, identity, and love, and who the Father is. And I think that comes through in our writing. How could it not? It's so strong in both of our lives, though.
And was that faith always there growing up, though?
Yes, absolutely. The faith was always there growing up. Okay. I think it just took a different turn as, the faith was always there growing up. It just became more about identity and love and who are you inside the Father, who he calls you to be, versus what are, you know, the more elementary rules, what are just finding a real commitment and relationship versus just following laws that you're taught as a child,
right.
Which I think is just a natural progression everyone takes as they get older.
Yeah, I think the idea of finding purpose is certainly something that happens as you get older.
Yeah.
Rather than looking outside, looking inside for it. But, you know,
definitely.
Today I think that people are so confused. Everybody, mm-hmm. I'm a life coach, and everybody comes, what is my purpose? What is my purpose? I hear it all the time. And mm-hmm. so you are very young to understand that your purpose is already inside you. What would you tell people who say, mm-hmm. you know, Rochelle, what's my purpose?
Yeah, I hope people don't ask me that. No, that's not true.
don't ask me that question.
I think that if I get that a lot, actually. I had surrounded myself with aspiring writers and successful writers just because of what I learned from them. Everyone's journey is different, and it's just good to be around people who do what I do as well and understand that. So I have a lot of friends who are young, female, aspiring writers, and there's kind of a lot of rejection in that. And, you know, this idea that I feel called to be a writer, to share my truth, but nobody will listen, so then maybe my truth isn't worth listening to or my purpose isn't worth having. And so when I have those conversations, I usually just encourage people to remember that this, your purpose is not necessarily to be a writer. I wouldn't say, I don't think your purpose is necessarily to be published. I don't think your purpose is necessarily to, you know, be successful. I think the deeper message is that your purpose is to understand who you are in your Father. And when you do that, the rest doesn't matter. The rest becomes kind of like a game. Yes, I'd love to be published. Yes, I'd love to do well. Yes, I'd love to write full time. These are all things that I'm very interested in, but my real purpose is actually away from that. My real purpose is, who am I called to as a child of the Father, and how then do I now respond to people and heartache and hardship and joy, and how do I deal with all those things knowing who my true identity is? And then the rest of it, just it lets go of the pressure and it lets you just enjoy the successes and maybe not wallow so much in the failures and just be grounded in who you really are.
Wow.
Was that too much, too fast?
I was open. No, it's awesome. I love it. I love that.
So,
yeah,
I'm not really good at it all the time. That's definitely for sure. I mean, life is a cycle of remembering and forgetting.
I think I read that you said that you were looking for that in all the wrong places.
Absolutely. I think probably everybody does that as well.
Right. So the idea of being acknowledged or your writing isn't as important to you, let's say, as being acknowledged as you as a person and how you react to the world? Maybe that's what you said.
Yeah, I definitely think, yes, I think that's definitely true. But I searched for it. I searched for my purpose, my identity, and my work to come you know, from the acknowledgments, of others
right.
for a long time, and I definitely still struggle with that, as we all do. But learning slowly to let that go.
Well, I think we all like to be acknowledged
yes.
for the things that we do. Our egos, you know, we live in an egocentric world. It's very difficult mm-hmm. to let that go at times. But, you know, we do. And when you start to look through a different lens at the world, it's kind of exciting. But your character, Carrington, she lived in a futuristic kind of dystopian world that had her as a female. Her worth was only valued if she was chosen as a bride. I mean, that was her
yes.
whole worth. Her whole identity was based upon that. And so where did that idea come from? You're married.
Well, I am married. Yes. I am married. I'm sorry, what?
Was that important to you to be married?
Yeah, well, I was going to say being married, I don't know, my husband's probably listening, was not that important to me. I love him dearly, obviously. But and this is something I talk about sometimes pretty frequently, so some may have heard it, some may have not. My journey really started when I was a teen, where I was in a pretty dark, not abusive necessarily, but a pretty dark relationship with a boy. As you know, a lot of girls do, the typical fell for the guy who was broken, you know, and took me down a path that was pretty dangerous to me, and really started to kind of wrap my entire identity up in him. Because when you're that young and impressionable, because you're constantly searching for validation, constantly searching for someone to make you feel worth it and beautiful and chosen, all of these elements that are very strong in the choosing. The first person who comes along and kind of really validates that and makes you feel, I mean, it's kind of intoxicating and nearly impossible not to fall for.
Right.
And I definitely did. And it was a very dark, kind of scary time of my life. I really abandoned a lot of truths, a lot of the people around me who were telling me this is dangerous, you'll end up hurt. And, of course, I did end up exactly as they all predicted. After coming out of that, it was probably 3 or 4 years in my late teens and into my early college years, where I had to kind of take a step back after breaking myself away from that by the grace of God and say, now who am I outside of not being chosen by a man? That's really where the journey started for me. Like, if I never end up being picked, quote unquote, as somebody's partner, then am I still worth it? Am I still the same? Am I still beautiful if nobody tells me? And I think that, you know, is
yeah,
a very heavy, yeah, like a really fundamental, a real base place to start. But my journey definitely started there for me with identity. And then I have two younger sisters, and watching both of them kind of enter into adulthood as well. One of them is 22 and the other one is 18. So they're both kind of in a very similar place that I was, and watching them ask the exact same questions and deal with the same struggles because I think that we all do.
How much older are you?
There's 10 years between me and my youngest sister.
Okay. Well,
10 and a half. So
you're a little bit older, but like, did you and your middle sister, did you play dress up and bride and, you know, to get married and talk about what your wedding was going to look like as little girls?
Yeah, my middle sister was totally a tomboy, so not really necessarily, but my mom will tell you that I knew what wedding dress I was going to wear at the age of 4. I cut a picture out of a magazine and put it on the fridge and kind of wore that dress. Actually, it's very similar, which is hilarious. 20 years later.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. But I think women, I think girls, you know, we're brought up with the idea that we're going to be brides, and it's this beautiful day where you get to be a princess, and so it's so important to us. And I think as you get older and it hasn't happened to you yet, you start to, you know, imagine ways that it has to happen, because and maybe start to settle, maybe, you know, or think about it, because it's so important. Parents and grandparents, or when are you getting married? When you, I know it happened to me. When are you getting married? You know, when are those grandchildren coming? And so, you know, you start to think, geez, I don't know. If he's not, you know, Prince Charming isn't coming, then Mr. Today, you know, might, Mr. Right Now or whatever might be the guy I have to choose. And so you kind of make that happen for themselves rather than waiting. I mean, in your book, Carrington, it's not about love. It's just about being chosen. Love doesn't enter in, right? So love and marriage have nothing to do with anything. Right. And love, it, actually, in all of the relationships in the families, it didn't seem like love had anything to do with anything. Because, you know, the child's going to be an instrument to bring, just like throughout the Middle Ages, an instrument. Women were the instrument that brought land together and money together and power together. And so same, I think, with Carrington, that it was, you know, her mother wanted her to marry well because it was going to look good on her, the reflection to the family. Not that she really loved her necessarily. Only you know if the mother loved her or not. But it didn't feel that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that in that instance, specifically, I think that I took a very common feeling, maybe not for all, but for some, I think it's parents. I'm not a parent yet, but I am an older sister, and I'm very close with my parents, and I have lots of friends who are starting that journey of parenthood. And I think you just want what's best for your child always, and sometimes wanting what society has told them is best feels like the opposite of love. But I feel like for Carrington's mother, she was raised in a society where all the truth that she was ever told was that if her daughter wasn't chosen, then she was a failure as a mother, her daughter was a failure as a woman, society rejected her, and so she desperately wanted her daughter to not have to live through that. And so in a twisted way, she didn't know how else to love her but to just want her so badly to be chosen. And I'm not saying that her mother reacted properly or healthily or that their relationship is a good example of a mother-daughter relationship, and it's definitely not a reflection of mine because my mom is super awesome. But I think that, you know, she didn't know any other way to be than how she was, just because of the way that she'd been raised and how important being chosen in the society that I created was. And I actually think that importance on being chosen is as important in the society we live in. Obviously,
but the father seemed to have a loving relationship with the daughter.
Yes.
Maybe that was, you know, your relationship that you have with your dad. And I said in the marketing promo that the video that you did with your dad, if you didn't see that and you're listening, Rochelle and Ted had a, Ted interviewed Rochelle in a video, and you can find that online. And just that feeling of love that came between, you know, and the excitement and how proud he was of you in that video, I really was thinking, gee, I'd love to do a video on father-daughter because I have that same relationship with my dad. He was, you know, you could be whatever you want to be, and he was, you know, the guy who said that to me. Now, your dad told you not to be a writer. He discouraged you in the beginning. And he,
for
why
many
did
years.
He discourage you?
I think that my dad is a realist, definitely, which is kind of surprising because he lives in a fantastical world all the time. And then he probably has multiple personalities, so it seems a little bit strange to use that word with him, associated with him. But he's definitely a realist and a businessman that understands the ins and outs of publishing very well and knows how difficult the journey is and knows that I'm young, or, you know, especially when I came to my dad and said, hey, I want to write, I was 19 or 20, so very young, still trying to figure out who I was, obviously, and he was like, this is a world full of rejection, this is a world that will beat you down, this is a world where, at the fragile place that you are, where you're still coming out of this, you know, toxic relationship and trying to figure out who you are and find your own two feet and figure out what you want to do with your life. And, you know, at that point I knew my husband, but, you know, we weren't dating yet. And so it was just like one of those times where everything was changing and everything was new. And I think he was fearful that if I threw myself in, which I did anyway, that I would just end up crushed. And so I think he was trying to protect me. What did you say?
I said you're not a recent success. You know, overnight success. You've been writing for almost 10 years, right?
Yeah. So, I think that I ignored him, thankfully, I think now. I said, well, forget you. I'm going to do it anyways, which has pretty much always been my attitude, which is why I easily got in trouble.
Do that. But, I get it. As a parent, you want to protect your child. But as that child, you say, well, I need to go through and make those same mistakes and have those same experiences so that, A, you know, I'm a hands-on learner, and B, it might not turn out that way for me.
Yeah.
You never know.
Yeah. I think that through my, being that way, I wrote an article recently for a guest blog, and I said, I started it with, I'm one of those kids who had to touch the stove. Like you said, don't touch the stove, it's hot. And I said, are you sure? Let me just do it.
Yeah.
And then get burned. Like, that was always who I was. My sister, the one that's closest in age to me, my middle sister, she is not that way. Like, she will just believe you. Her ability to have blind faith is astounding. I think that through having me as the oldest child and my dad watching me be that way, he's now much different with my younger sisters. And I think now if I was coming to him with this grand idea of wanting to write, he'd be like, okay, this is your journey. You take it. I'll support you, encourage you, love you, through it. And he wouldn't be so fearful. I think he's learned to, of course I'm the first, so it just took some time. And I'm so much like him. I think that was the other thing. My mom, you'll hear her say, I'll say something in the car and she'll just laugh and roll her eyes. And I'll look at her and I'll say, what? She said, you sounded so much like Ted right then. It was scary. and so I think he knowing like all the internal struggle and battle of rejection and, being told no and then not selling any copies. And then, that whole thing, the whole world, he was just like, why can't you just be a dentist? Like, you go to school and then you get a job or a nurse or, like, why the hard path?
I just want to say we had a caller, and I hope she calls back because I'm going to take your call if you call me back. I'm sorry. I just wanted to understand this idea. I wanted to hear Rochelle talk about what she just mentioned. And I just want to ask you one more question, Rochelle, and hopefully this caller will call us back. But the idea of rejection, how did you handle or did you have to handle rejection?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I wrote 5 novels before The Choosing. The Choosing is my 6th novel. So I wrote 5 before this that were the first 2 I just worked with editors on. Both told me it wasn't good enough. The 3rd and 4th one I actually did. 3rd, 4th, and 5th I went a little bit further, talked to some acquisition editors, talked to some managers and agents. And then The Choosing itself actually was rejected by several publishers. So,
how many publishers did you have to go through? I mean, give people an idea if they're writers, like don't give up after number 5 or what?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and now I have a very hands-off approach to publishing, which some people don't do, but I find that the less I know, the better. So I have an amazing agent who just pretty much takes care of me. She's like godsend. And so I just said, here's the manuscript that I think it's ready. I worked with an editor, got it to my agent. She was like, and she sent it to a ton of publishers. I know of 6 or 7, and I got a call back from 1, who is Tyndale, who I'm published with now. So
if you're new to writing, you suggest that people get an agent? It's the best
always.
Way to do it.
Yeah, they have connections. I mean, very few publishers will look at a manuscript if it's not sent through an agency.
Okay.
Unless it's like an indie publisher, a small, it all depends on what route you're going. Self-publishing, obviously, you don't necessarily need an agent right away. And indie publishing, when you're working with small houses, where you're paying a lot of your own costs, and it's not quite the same as traditional publishing, which is what I the path I took, and I have friends who are doing all three, so are in every arena. I think that it's different for your journey, but if you're into traditional publishing, like I've done, either ABA or CBA, so that's like Christian Book Association or American Book Association, those are the two different chains, I guess, of publishing, then in the traditional publishing world, then having an agent is almost necessary, I would say. I don't know of anyone who's done it without an agent, but that's just my experience. And finding an agent is like finding a publisher. You want somebody who understands you, who believes in your book, who you feel very comfortable with. And so, don't just work with the first agent necessarily that's interested in you unless it's a really good fit, because this is a person that's going to be kind of like your coach. Like, they keep you safe and, things go through them in case there's any hard conversations to have about the novel. You kind of have somebody to be a buffer. It's a very good relationship. I'm sorry, what kind of price?
Do you pay for an agent?
They don't make money unless you make money.
Okay.
Traditionally, or in my case, and it all depends on what your contract is, but they get paid a certain percentage of whatever you make per novel.
Okay.
And that, gets written up in your contract.
Let's talk about women now. Let's talk about this idea. What do you think about women's liberation has affected your generation? Was it a good thing or a bad thing?
I think good, primarily. There are always extreme cases in a negative way, but I think liberation of women has been really positive. I think we are, for the first time in a long time, really carving out paths for ourselves apart from this idea that we need a male or a man to somehow help us along the way. You see women like taking charge, starting their own businesses. You have women who work full time and, men who stay at home. I think the roles between men and women are definitely changing. And I think for the better, because it gives women the opportunity to feel equal, even though that they already were.
I think we decided to tell us we weren't. And is there something wrong with being different? I mean, I don't think I want my husband or man to be the same as me.
Right.
I think it's kind of nice that, he's strong or whatever. And even though I know I can use a screwdriver, it's kind of nice to allow him to do it because it makes him feel good.
Right. Oh, yeah. I mean, I never take the trash out.
You always have to be
Forget
so
that.
Independent. But the confidence that the equality brings, even with all of that, we watched your video and we see women every day, the Dove commercials, whatever. We lack confidence in ourselves, in our self-esteem, in our bodies especially. Like, it doesn't seem to matter how thin you are. You're never thin enough or beautiful enough, or there's always something that's marring your beauty. And love that you have for yourself. Like, man, I mean, you come so far, and yet it seems like we're going backwards in other areas.
Well, I think the root cause of that is that the problem is that we are searching for validation in all of the areas that don't matter. So, first it may have been primarily just men. We need men to pick us. And then we kind of evolved and we're like, wait, we don't need men. We just need careers. And wait, we don't need careers. We just need to be single mothers. And wait, we don't need, we can be whatever size we want. This whole idea of identity is still searching for validation in something versus realizing all the validation you need already exists within you. So it's a total culture shift that needs to happen. And so, regardless of how independent we become, it doesn't really matter because we're still searching for identity in something other than ourselves and the one who created us.
So if somebody doesn't have, let's say you don't have religious upbringing. But there's many spiritual people and humanists and people out there. And so this love that you talk about, this father and the love, what does that mean to you, really? Like, how would you explain that to somebody else? How would you tell a friend of yours about this?
Yeah, I think, love. I think everybody, regardless of what they believe and where they come from and whether they're religious or not, identifies with this idea of love and unconditional love and this search for acceptance and love, really, is all anyone's ever, reaching for or searching for. And so I think to instead of saying, using religious terms, if you just use the term of love, I believe that all we are called to do as humans is to first love ourselves, and in loving ourselves, learn to love others. I think that is a huge goal, or not goal, of purpose of mine.
It is a goal.
A goal too, because we're definitely not
there.
Very
few people do.
If I can learn to totally love myself, which means my true self, who I am when the lights are off and there's nobody around and you've ripped away all of these roles that we play, wife, woman, career, stay-at-home mom, whatever those daughter, sister,
label.
All those roles that we play, which are very important, but if you strip them all away and you're just yourself in the dark, do you love that person? And if you can come to a place where you do and then learn to love others through that, then, you've figured out something that everybody is striving for.
Right.
So I think it's just about love.
Why is it so hard to love ourselves? Why is that so difficult? I mean, as children, we love ourselves, I think. I mean, the idea of the ego is very strong, but, I can think of somebody, I can think of myself as somebody else and love them with lots of empathy and love. But when you look at yourself, it then says, no, you're not worthy. Or maybe, I don't know if it's worthiness or you can't see yourself separate from who you think you look like or whatever it is. I mean, our body is a car. It's the vehicle we drive around in as we go through this world. It's not who we are. And yet we identify so greatly with it because, we have to have facelifts and tummy tucks and all this thing to make us feel better than other people maybe or worthwhile to ourselves. And yet, this love, which is so simple, so easy, so difficult to give to oneself. I mean, how many of your friends do you think, love themselves unconditionally?
Yeah, well, constantly, none.
Yeah.
I think we have
it's
moments
a work
of
in progress,
it. Yeah. It's a total work in progress. I mean, one of my dad's favorite sayings and one I use in the book often is life is the cycle of remembering and forgetting. Like you have these moments where, and I have them, and I have experienced them, and they're so great. Like where you're sitting in front of the mirror, and you're looking at yourself, and you're like, man, I am awesome. I mean, and not like in a self-serving
way.
Not in an ego way, like in a way where you're like, I am really blessed to, and I feel great, and I really love who I am, and I'm proud to be this person, and I'm excited to be growing and changing, and this is great. Like I have right now, I wouldn't change anything about myself. And literally 30 seconds later, I'll be like, oh, but I have a pimple. And why do I have adult acne? That's so stupid. And oh my God, I should lose 5 pounds. And this shirt really isn't flattering. I mean, like in the same moment. And it is insanity. It really is insanity because it is so easy. Like you said, to love it. So easy, and we do it as children, and then we forget as the knowledge of the world enters into our mind, and you start getting these ideas of, oh, maybe that's not fashionable, you shouldn't wear that, or, oh, I should get A's and not B's, and, oh, I should play sports, or I shouldn't play sports, or all of these things kind of slowly over time start to shape the your truth and the way that you view the world, and you start to forget that you actually don't need to be any of those things, and none of those things give you purpose, and none of those things really matter, and you lose that love for yourself, and it's just the ego quietly creeping in and telling you you should be this or you should be that, or you'll be better if you're, or you'll be stronger if you're, and how do you avoid that? I mean, I don't know. If someone has the answer, please tell me. I'm searching.
No, I'm wondering if
constantly,
it's because. It's our socialized self that walks through this world. I mean, my book was about midlife and that it's not a crisis but a metamorphosis. And so there's this idea that we're breaking free of our socialized self to become our true self. And
right.
So I wonder if, like, your father was, you know, his parents were missionaries and he was brought up in a place where it was very unsocialized. And
right.
So I wonder if those people loved one another. I wonder if they can love themselves more than somebody in this society can, because mm-hmm. of all the pressure from the press and magazines and people telling you what's beautiful and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That would be a great question to ask him. I know he personally struggled with identity and worth as a five-year-old, being sent to boarding school and being separated from his parents and realizing, oh, nobody loves me. I'm alone. I'm all
right.
I've got in this world. At 5 years old, he learned that and has been unlearning it for the last, you know, 45 years because it's like it only takes one moment, it only takes one second for the world or the ego to tell you a lie, and then you go, oh, maybe you're right, and you second guess everything you already know. It's like growing up, we like learn all of these things, and then we get to a place where like, okay, now I have to unlearn everything I just learned about myself because it was all
right.
crap.
It was all
I mean, it's
lies.
Crazy.
Our mind lies to us.
It's all
so
lies.
I can't believe anything yeah. that you tell yourself. True.
Yeah, unless
it's
it is
so
you are awesome and you are, you know, perfect and wonderful and just the way you should be. Those are the only things that you should be believing about yourself. But
I
it's really hard to do.
I mean, you just mentioned your dad at five, but is there a difference between men and women and how our confidence and self-esteem and guys, you know, you can look at a guy can be overweight and think he's like God's gift, right? So they have other
yeah.
insecurities. Have you found any, like, even with your own husband, let's say, or does he think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are different issues. Mm-hmm. For example, the second novel in this, it's called The Calling in this series.
Okay, yeah, let's mention it. It is a series. It's a series of three, right?
Yeah, it is a series of three, yeah.
What is it, a Seeker novel?
The Seer series. Mm-hmm. And the second book titled The Calling is due early spring next year. And it is actually all from a man's perspective.
Okay.
Which was a really interesting journey for me to take. Obviously, I'm not a man. So that was really fun to kind of challenge myself. And, you know, his real struggle is, you know, how am I a failure? Like, how can I, the fear of failure, the fear of letting the people he loves down, the fear of not being strong enough, the fear of not measuring up, which is really the exact same fear we have of not being beautiful. We just mm-hmm. use different words to talk about it. So, no, I don't think men and women are different necessarily. I think at the end of the day, we're all searching for acceptance and unconditional love, and we just look for it in different places. And it fails us in different places, but it's still the same failure, and it's still the same search. Does that make sense?
Mm.
That's my take. So, like, my husband may not care if he gains 10 pounds, where I would definitely care if I gained 10 pounds. But, you know, if for some reason, you know, we get to a month where we can't pay the bills, then he, like, literally can't sleep. Where I'm like, oh, it'll be fine. It'll all work. I think we just have different...
Priority.
And that's not necessarily true for all men and women, but in general, I think right. we just search for identity in different places, but it's still the same search, you know.
Right. Interesting. It's interesting how we all walk through this.
Definitely.
World.
Yeah, well, we're all the same. That's the great thing that I've been learning in this journey and talking to other women and talking, you know, some women, you know, they are more career focused than image focused. Which is great. So it's more about, like, how do I be the best in a man's world, you know, because they're very career-oriented. And some are, like, you know, I have women or friends who are trying to have children, and they're struggling with that. And so their identity is in that. Where I have other, you know, friends who just want to be a size 4 instead of a size 6, which is ridiculous. But, you know, so you have these different areas. But we're really all the same, which is a beautiful thing. We're all connected. We're not really that different from one another when you get right down to the base of it. We all just want to be loved, and we all really want to love
and we're all searching for that. And so it's kind of, you know, it's like nice. We could like rally together and be the same. There's not a lot that separates us, actually.
Right.
Which yeah. is beautiful.
That's true. I mean, you know, the things that separate us are things like religion. You know, people
mm-hmm.
take a stand and it becomes a wall.
Yeah.
You know, ideologies separate people. And yet, when we have a common goal, we've seen the best in people. When there's
always.
A crisis, that people need to come together as one.
Mm-hmm.
We do know how to do that. So maybe that's the remembering part. And then the forgetting
yeah.
part is when it's over. And you go back to your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that if we could really see each other as the same, could really see each other in, you know, when we do, you see that this happen in the country all the time when there are times of crisis, like you said, we all come together and it's amazing what we can accomplish. It's kind of sad that we can't be that way always.
Right.
Because you just see that, okay, maybe your ideology and my ideology are different, but does that really make us, the true us, different? Or does it just mean, you know, on this crazy roller coaster of life, you know, you've decided to leave that and I've decided to leave that, this, but that doesn't mean I can't still love you regardless of what you believe. And we don't have to have this wall and this barrier, which is very, very difficult to do because our ideologies are wrapped up in our ego. So when people tell us what we believe is wrong, we feel offended and we feel unaccepted and unloved. And so it's a crazy mind game that we're always playing with each other.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of rejection, again, you know, it's a theme here. And I know that it's very difficult for people to handle rejection. And I asked you about your own, you know, feeling of rejection with, and so you buffered that with having an agent. But you know, I like to play a game with rejection. It's like, you know, well, I know that if I get 10 no's, I'm going to get a yes. So there's the game, right? Game on.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see how many no's I can
right.
get first. And keep it positive
yeah.
and but it is
that's
very
great.
Difficult for some people to come back from that rejection. And
mm-hmm.
they take it people go, well, don't take it personally, Michelle.
Right.
Don't take it personally that we didn't like your first five books. Like,
right.
But
like, I'm not going to take that personally. Why would you even say that?
It's so personal
yeah.
because your heart and soul is in that writing.
Oh, yeah.
And yet it's not personal.
Right.
Right? It's just something
mm-hmm.
that they said, no, it's not good enough. We don't like it. It doesn't, you know, our readers, it's not for them. So, you
right.
know, what advice or, you know, maybe your father even said to you, I mean, he tried to steer you away from it. So what advice do you tell people today when rejection, what would you say when rejection comes their way? And how do
yeah.
you bring yourself back to moral? So, hey, I am good.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, after a really good cry and you know, a, like dozen cookies, that's usually what I first suggest because that's what usually happens to me.
Right.
Yeah, just cookies and crying. No, that's terrible. Don't do that. Or do that. That's fine, too.
Well, do it.
I mean,
I think
do that. I think that you have to remember, I mean, I think that you said it beautifully, that it is a game.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you learn to disassociate your identity from your success that you can really disassociate yourself with rejection. So when you learn, which no, we're all still learning, I'm definitely still I still struggle with this. But when you learn that being published does not give me worth or being accepted, but I mean, you know, that's
exciting.
Really, that's when you can find true freedom then.
Right.
You find true
right.
freedom then when you can let go, when you don't care, when you're like, this is just a game and I'm going to hopefully get this book published, but if not, no big deal, which seems like how can you actually live that way? And it's very difficult and I don't do
difficult.
A great job at it. But I mean, when you can just like let it go and let it be, then you find really true freedom. And, you know, I strive to be that way constantly because it's such a nice place to live. You know,
okay, we have a caller.
Not have to. Yeah, okay, cool.
Hello? What? Hello? Area 541?
Frankie?
Yeah, hi.
Hello? Hi.
Hi.
Tatiana. I made
it. Hi, Tatiana, how are you? Yeah.
I'm good. Three phones later.
Well, that's okay. Better late than never, right?
That's what they say.
Thanks for calling back.
That's That's what all the late people say.
That's what the late people say. So, you know, I don't know how much of the conversation you heard, and do you have thoughts about women and the central theme about your worth and your value in society?
Oh, no, not at all. Never thought of it myself. Yeah, I can just tell you, I can represent a small voice for they call it the first wave of volunteers. That's another word for baby boomers from 1945 mm-hmm. to 65, which is, I think, 70 billion or millions, quite a few. And I think as every generation ages, I guess that's the word to use, you know, lives, is still alive, I guess, then that's to look at. You know, in the Four Noble Truths, you know, one of the truths is old age is a disease. And, you know, when I was 20, I didn't believe in any of that stuff. Now I'm like, oh, maybe there's some truth to that. So it's a constant awareness of redefining as a woman, especially in a negative patriarchy, what is the value? I mean, as a young hippie, the value was pretty clear and it was pretty simple. You just be really cute and the rest of it will follow, you know. And then as things change, it's like, what is the value? Is it deeper than all the things we've been taught and trained and the unworthy we were raised in? I mean, in my generation, we were raised in unworthy. I mean, it was like a part of the training. But, of course, that was the perfection of then, you know, awakening out of that nightmare of the egoic separate sense of self, hopefully, continually, and embracing the real core of our essential self, which is just consciousness. It's not even a form. So I think as people, especially redefining the new civilization, we're here for something new. And trying to uncondition the conditioned mind while being in the conditioned mind is the real journey.
I love that.
You know, because
wow,
if you don't
amazing.
Know who you are.
That was heavy.
Sutra.
Yeah.
The simplest sutra. You know, when the Vedas said thousands of years ago, the world is as you are, they meant it. And I can attest to you as being a human being and in a female body that if I'm feeling good, it's like one day I thought, wow, I feel really good. I said, I wonder if I look good. It was like that. I went, it doesn't matter because the goal looking good is to feel good anyway, and I already feel good, so we're just going to call it good, you know. I
right.
mean,
mm-hmm.
And then without that liberation, what's the point, you know, after being, you know, so conditioned and programmed? I mean, I wish we just had
I have to ask you something. I have to ask you, okay, you mentioned, you know, started off as a hippie. In hippie, you know, hippies, we had free love. And so this idea of free love and loving one another, did that leave you after 5-10 years? Like, what happened to that love?
Oh, let's see, where did that, I do remember a bit of it, yeah. I was one of the originators, and I still am a hippie, with a free love. But the thing is, I think when there was innocence, I know on my part it was given freely, but there was already so much conditioning and being used as an object that it wasn't really free. Now it could be free, you know, because if you don't know who you are, you're not free. When I look back, I'm like, God, it's horrifying. All the conditioning. I mean, it's amazing anybody gets out at all to look at the light of the box, because it's like being buried alive. It's like, wow, wow. But, you know, many of us know, obviously knew coming in, that there was a problem here. I mean, when I was 7, I said, look, I want to speak to the management. There is a problem here. Who's in charge? You know,
yeah.
I spent the rest of my life still figuring it out. You know, not from the mind, but from just like every day. It's like, wow, here I am. I'm alive somehow.
So
and
as you're aging, you're reinventing yourself in order to accommodate
only
that ego and understand your worth.
From reinventing instead of going to the material world, which I would like to do as a Capricorn, but spirit has something else in mind apparently. But having to do it from some authentic place. That's really free, that says you don't get to have anything. Who you are is not dependent on things, because then that's not free. As we know, the millionaires suffer. It's not about any of that. And it's easy to say that when you have $1 million, you know.
Right.
But as a person who doesn't have $1 million, I can tell you that I've had to build anything that I've had in terms of my own self-love and self-worth from just some divine place, going outside of everything I've been taught and trained to the best of my ability.
Well, when you live in fear of not, you know, fear of hunger, fear of not having a home, fear of, you know, your necessities to to
survival,
to feel that love, right? To feel love when you're living in fear.
Right, right. There are really, and I can tell you, as being a single mother and gone through a huge journey, like so many people, very intense, still alive, is that radiating the vortex of fear from survival is a whole other set of, you know, realities, and it brings with it that law of attraction from there. But to be able to vibrate in a frequency that's not trying to get something from anybody, you know, then
right.
there's a little more freedom in that. And then that's actually love. You know, it's like, how do you treat the person you're never going to see again? Are you nice to the strangers? You know, do you want something? And there's very
mm-hmm.
subtle agendas. You know, like Maharishi would say, every love is towards the self. It's always about the self. It doesn't matter how we dress it. Even Mother Teresa, you know, it's just the way it is. It's the nature of reality. So,
self-love, Rochelle, it sounds
self-worth.
Like there's like 30 years between you and Indiana, but you register, you find an affinity there.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of just like, where do you live? Can I come hang out at your house?
I'm in Ashland right now. That I'm going back to Hawaii. Come and live. I have amazing children. My one amazing daughter, she's 30 something, and
It's very powerful
to work within your lineage. I tell you, you know, there's three generations here.
I believe it. I just think pretty much everything you just said was beautiful and right on. I mean, it's that, you know, disassociating yourself with I need to be happy or to love that I just, I mean, I hope that there are people that are listening to this and that the things that you are saying are resonating with them because they're super powerful. And I just thought that was so awesome. So.
Well, you know, I saw your interview your dad did with you, and I did an interview with my daughter also once, and it's really fun, and it was cute to see you together.
Yeah.
And see that you had your own integrity, you know, as a writer. And I liked the part where he tried to talk you out of being a writer.
Yeah.
And he is one, right? Well, you know, my sense of it, I didn't get to get your book yet, but I'm going to actually buy one for one of my children, because I think it's a very important theme. And if we can help your generation and my daughter, you know, we have to help each other because it's so... You know, it's big, whatever.
Yeah.
But it is just one human at a time. But see what happens. Like, I do readings and stuff. And your astrology, I would imagine, your galactic astrology, you know, this is a time for you to come out to the bigger territory of influence. Because one person talking to another person is amazing. And women are cool because they can talk. I met a woman the other day I had never met before. The instant we set eyes, we talked for hours. I don't even remember what it was about. It was just like this amazing, but it wasn't just talking, it was meditation and stuff, but it was just this amazing
mm-hmm.
affinity. So that's powerful, but doing less and accomplishing more, as Marge would say, taking your book.
Oh. Hello? Are you still there too?
I'm here.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Oh, we lost Indiana.
Well, that was sad because she was great.
Yeah, she's pretty cool.
Yeah, pretty cool.
The hippies are coming out. I love it. Yeah, but she's definitely said something very profound, and I think it should go into your book.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
Yeah, no kidding.
You've just given your consent.
Yeah.
I love the conscious, socially conscious mind kit.
I know.
I do. That was great. That was brilliant. Love it.
That was, I know, I'm sure that I'll have to quote that to my dad. He'll geek out over that. He loves that stuff. So
yeah. Well,
yeah.
I want to wish you all the best, Rochelle. I think you're just an amazing young woman, and you know, very, very deep for all. You know, your thinking is just so intense and deep for your years, and maybe you came in here an old soul. I don't know, but. I really admire you. I really do. And I think you know, as I said before, you're a terrific writer. And I'm really excited to read the next part of this series that you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what the third book's going to be about? Do you already know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm actually writing the third book now.
Oh, are you?
The second book's done. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The way the publishing world works is everything's done, like, 9 or 12 months in advance, because it takes so long to get through the copy editing and the printing and the, you know, all getting it shipped to stores. So book two has been done for a while now, and I'm getting ready. I should say I'm not technically writing book three yet. I start Monday, August 3rd, but I am doing all the outlining and the I'm big into outlining and structuring the story and really what is the theme going to be and where am I going to take these characters after book two. And so I'm in the midst of that now. I'm pretty excited about it.
And
so.
Is Carrington still in the book in book two? Or is,
she is in book two. Book two, book two is Carrington and Rumco very heavily. And then book three, they definitely both are there and present, but it's a story of somebody else that's connected to them. So, but it all, you'll see in the similar themes through the whole thing, identity, fear, forgiveness, how do we exist, you know, how do we change the way we interact with people when we really, detach ourselves from this learned consciousness and find our true selves. And then what does, you know, being fearless and being and real forgiveness look like in that space? Because I think it's probably really different in the way that we define it. When we're dealing with the ego. So
that sounds exciting. I can't wait to read that. So we've been talking to Michelle Decker, and her last name is spelled DEKKER, and her book is called The Choosing, and you can find it on Amazon.com, CA, probably Europe. is it in the bookstores as well?
It is, yep, it's in bookstores. So, you know, Lifeways, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million.
Excellent. Good for you. Good for you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I, as I said, I wish you all the best in your career as a writer, and I probably don't have to because it's going to be amazing anyway. But thank you so much for being my guest today and coming on the show. And
thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Awesome. Okay, everybody, you've been listening to Rochelle Decker. Her book is called The Choosing. Go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and pick it up because you will not be disappointed, I do promise you. Thanks again, Rochelle. Take care. Have yourself an awesome day. And
thanks, you
my
too.
Listeners, have yourself an awesome day, too, wherever you are in the world. I appreciate you joining us. And if you're listening to the archive version, thank you for downloading. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us. This has been the Good Radio Network with the Princess of Positivity, Frankie Picasso. Are you ready to walk the talk, turn talk into doing? Then get out there and do a world of good. You've got the power.